Donald on a Kitchen talks about food. Donald on a Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on a Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donald on a Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Pruskintas.
We gather here once a week at the studios of KHOY Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames, Iowa. We talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. Well, we had a little snow for Easter.
I thought it was Christmas.
I thought so, too. And it was kind of, it was kind of beyond pretty, okay? I'm through with that. But we got over that, and the spring is still coming. That's good. And we should warm up a little bit. Yes, I do. Well, let's start today's show with a few food news items from the Donald on a Kitchen News Department. Tick-a-tick-tick-a-tick-tick-a-tick-tick-a-tick. That's our ticker tape from the News Department. We have one. Yes, we do. First thing I'd like to mention is watch out for those Lucky Charms, folks.
That's cereal, Lucky Charms.
Yeah, cereal.
Children's cereal.
Ah, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration is investigating Lucky Charms cereals after dozens of customers complained of illness.
Intestinal disorders, I believe it was.
Oh, my. So,
but they're still not saying what caused it or why.
Okay. But it's enough.
We're suspicious.
Enough to make the news, so be careful out there. Breakfast can be a dangerous place. Yes, it can. Another news item, and this is a little more dire, and it has to do with what's going on in Ukraine. Russia bombed celebrity chef Jose Andre's community kitchen in Kharkiv last Saturday, I do believe, along with bombing a whole bunch of other stuff. There are people in this horrible situation in Ukraine that are trying to help, like Chef Jose Andre.
Feed people.
He's got something called the World Central Kitchen. And how can you argue with that? Go and feed people that are hungry. Unfortunately, one of his kitchens got bombed.
Apparently no one died, however.
Fortunately. No one in the kitchen died.
Yeah.
So they're at it again. We wish them all the best, and I do hope that the food kitchen keeps on going, because kitchens need to keep on going. Yes. Well, here on the Donald on a Kitchen, we talk about where our food comes from. It all comes down to the earth. It all comes down to the land. Our guest today has thought a lot about the land in his long career as the director of Drake University Agricultural Law Center. His new book is entitled The Land Remains, A Midwestern Perspective on Our Past and Future. Welcome, Neil Hamilton. Welcome.
Well, welcome. Thank you very much, Donna and Lana, for having me join you today. I look forward to our conversation.
Good, good. Well, Neil Hamilton has been retired now, but he's been at Drake since 1983.
A long and storied history he has.
Kinds of good things. He has an area of expertise in agricultural law, land use, legislation, food and the law, environmental regulation. There's lots to talk about. And I just finished, well, both Donna and I finished reading your latest book. You've written many others, but why did you write this book, The Land Remains, A Midwestern Perspective on Our Past and Future? Why did you write this book?
Well, I wrote it because I had a number of kind of stories and insights that I wanted to share. It was a book that I probably started on four or five different occasions over the years as I would think about the legal issues I was dealing with and how they related to our land, particularly here in Iowa. And when I retired from full-time teaching 3 years ago, I thought, well, if I'm ever going to write this book, I need to actually sit down and write it. And then, ironically, you know, one of the silver linings that we could find from the pandemic was that I wasn't going anywhere, right? I wasn't traveling around, giving talks, going to conferences. And so I said, you know, you need to sit down and write it. And so I sat down and wrote every day for the next 9 months and produced this book. And it was a book that I'm sure, you know, as you write things, it kind of feels like it needed to come out, right? And it didn't write itself, but it, at the same time, it wasn't a challenge to write it. You know, it's a you're a cooking show, and you don't eat a cake all at once, and you don't bake it without a number of ingredients. And writing a book, you know, it just it grew, and I'd assemble it with these different passages I'd write or stories I would tell, and then think about how they could be woven together and the chapter structure, and that's what emerged. So I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yes, one thing I found this a rather unique and fun way to talk about your topic here. You actually have the land as a character in your book. You refer to something called the Back 40, and in the book, that actually, the land actually pops up and says, here,
it has
my
a voice
story.
Of its own, yeah.
Yeah, it's a whole book in itself.
Very clever literary device there,
yeah.
Neil.
Can you, where does the Back 40 come from?
Well, thank you for, I'm glad you liked it and that you didn't find it gimmicky. And I don't necessarily bill myself as a creative writer, but Don, I appreciate your comment that it was an effective device. And in terms of where it comes from, I mean, this is a real back 40. I mean, it's a back 40 in the sense that we had a 160 quarter section and we had a 40. Back off the back end of it. And so it was essentially in the middle of the section. It was the farthest field to get to. You really couldn't see it from the road because it was isolated in the middle of the mile. It was probably the best field that we had. It was very flat laying. It kind of sat on a ridge between two watersheds. And so I've always thought about the back 40 as I think about land issues. And so then as I was writing this book, I thought, well, you know, we never listen to the land. As Leopold said, when we talk about the land, we usually are talking about the people on the land, not the land itself. And so what would the land say? What would it tell us about its history and how it perceives what's happening and the perspective it might share? And so that's how I came to use it. And I can go back and look at my notes in the day that I first started writing, and then I'm making a note to myself, gosh, I wonder if this would work, that I could actually share some of these thoughts in the voice of the Back 40, and it kind of grew like Topsy. And so the Back 40 became a character.
And it's a fine character it is, too. It actually stands by itself. It reminds us that the land endures a lot longer than we are. Here's a quote of yours that I pulled up. I don't know why I pulled up this quote, but I like this. This is a quote from you. The land is going to long outlive us. It's going to transfer into somebody else's hands, maybe our children, maybe not. And they're going to make decisions on how to use it. And to some extent, the face of what we see on the land is really the portrait of its owner. So, As human beings, well, actually, as recent human beings, we had this idea of ownership of the land. So who really owns the land? And why should even non-landowners care about who owns the land?
Sure. Well, there are several answers that your question has triggered. And first one I would say is that we're all landowners, and the book talks about that. There's an extensive discussion of public land. And so even though somebody may not be fortunate enough to own a section or a quarter section of farmland, lots of people own their homes and own their yards, but we all own the public lands. So we have over 1 billion acres of public land in the United States, and most folks don't have to go more than a few minutes from their home to come to a piece of public land, a city park, a trail, a county park. And so we're all landowners. And one of the values, I think, of people thinking about the land is that it helps you think about that responsibility that we may have to the land. And if you are a landowner, right, or you're a tenant, or you're somehow involved in making the decisions about the land, well, then your kind of level of responsibility and involvement ratchets up because you actually have this issue of control or ownership. Now, and I'm a lawyer, and, you know, the book deals with a number of legal issues, and we oftentimes think of land in very legalized senses, right, that I own it in fee simple.
And my rights as a legal owner, right?
Yeah. But at the same time, as I also describe in the book, all land, even privately owned, is imbued with a public dimension, right? You're a fool if you think that your private land isn't, right, somehow imbued with a public dimension, and that there aren't other people that have an interest in it. And one of the best ways of thinking about that is try not paying your property taxes for a while and see what happens. Because, you know, the county can, in fact, assess the property taxes against it, only take the property away from you or have it sold at auction for failure to pay your property taxes. Well, the property taxes are really an obligation back to the public, right? The tax that we put on landowners to help cover the costs, whether it's roads or the sheriff or whatever it may be. And so land, even though we think of it as privately owned, you can't escape these other public responsibilities to your neighbors, to your heirs, to the state in the form of environmental laws that restrict how you use your property. And so thinking about land and thinking about it in that much kind of multidimensional way is also one of the goals of the book.
Yeah, there's not just land. Land we think of, well, do I think of it? We think of it as soil, dirt, but there's other things that we own in common that I think we've forgotten to take responsibility for, including the air, the water, the sunlight. In Britain and maybe some other places, in early America too, there was this concept of the commons. And no one wants to talk about that, probably because it sounds way too much like communism. But the idea of owning something in common. So there's a lot of things that can affect us if we don't take care of things like soil, air, water, and sunlight.
Well, a couple of comments Lana. I think, using the land as an expression can mean certainly soil and this kind of two-dimensional, okay, you know, here's the meets and bounds or here's the legal description. But land can also really be seen as a proxy for nature or all of these other kind of natural resources. And so it's the wildlife. It's the soil, it's the water, it's the rain that falls. And so certainly, you know, when Leopold was writing about the land ethic and talking about how we were in a community with the land as opposed to being riding on top of it in a dominating way, he was using, land in a broader sense. And on the point of the commons, we don't have commons in the sense of the way, they might have had them in Britain, which was kind of a piece of communally owned land that we all had the opportunity to graze our livestock on. And then, as Garrett Hardin wrote the famous piece called The Tragedy of the Commons, which was there's this kind of incentive on the part of people to overuse it because it doesn't have that singular ownership. But we certainly have resources that are commons, and one that people may not think of it in those terms, but those are the waters of the state,
mm-hmm.
right? In the 1960s, when the Iowa legislature reformed Iowa's water law, it declared all of the water in the state a public resource. And so the water that comes out of your tile line, the water flowing in a creek or stream, the water in a river, the water in our lakes, these are all a public resource owned by the public. Your ability to use water, groundwater and surface water both, are restricted by the state, and in many situations you may well need a permit to be able to withdraw them if you're above a certain level. And so that idea that the waters are public is also the basis for support for things like water quality protection and the duty or obligation that goes along with individuals in terms of how they use the water, and also an obligation on the part of the state agencies to actually protect the public's interest in those waters. That's what's known as the public trust doctrine.
Well, you have done a lot of work in this state on water quality, and I mean, I can't even begin to describe. You've made all kinds of, you worked a lot with the Des Moines Water Suit. I have this quote that you gave to somebody in Sierra Magazine. You said, "The idea that we're going to somehow achieve clean water on an entirely voluntary system, that's just magical thinking. There's no good reason to think that would happen." So you want to talk a little bit about how that sentiment has been received in the state?
Well, I've been referring to the nutrient reduction strategy as an exercise in magical thinking for years, because it really is. And our whole water kind of attitude towards water quality is based on kind of the original sin, the big lie, and magical thinking. And the original sin was making the distinction between point sources and non-point sources in the Clean Water Act, which was basically a way that we gave much of the pollution that might come off of agricultural activities kind of a slide.
Well, just for our audience, I want to explain that means, like, if a factory is dumping, chemicals into a river, that is called a single point.
If it's coming out of the end of the pipe, it's considered to be a point source. If it's coming off of a hillside
from a farm,
then we might treat that as a non-point source. But it's a non-scientific concept, and but it's embedded in the statute. And then the big lie is that we're doing everything we can, and everybody is concerned about the water. And then the magical thinking is this idea that we're going to somehow do this voluntarily. And, we have, in fact, compounded that by including actually in state law a provision that says there's no role for regulation when it comes to water quality protection. And, of course, that is just, from a public policy standpoint, a ludicrous idea in that we use regulations as a way to actually implement public policy, right? They're the way that we establish expected standards of behavior. The car that your listeners drive in has seat belts, has all types of safety provision. The apartment you live in has smoke detectors and fire escapes. And, builders don't say, well, I'm going to charge less for my rent but not put in smoke detectors, right? And so we're going to let people choose on an economic basis. You don't drive through a school zone at 60 and say you're a good driver, or go get liquored up and blow a .20 and say I can handle my liquor. I mean, we establish expected standards of conduct, and establishing those as it relates to water would be a natural part of how we would approach water quality protection. In fact, in some ways, you can measure the priority that society gives to a conduct based around the nature of how we use regulations to, in fact, incentivize it. And to the extent that we don't want to use regulations with water quality is another way of saying, well, we really don't care that much about it. We're going to somehow trust you voluntarily to do it. Beyond that, we have no devices or tools other than good wishes and economics and maybe some type of financial bribe to try to get you to do it. We certainly don't do that with soil, right? I mean, our state law on soil, there's a mandatory duty on the part of landowners to not exceed the soil loss limits established by the soil and water conservation districts. No comparable duty as relates to water quality, unfortunately.
Well, the result of this has made Iowa kind of one of the worst, maybe it is the worst in the nation in terms of our water quality. Everybody thinks, oh, it happened to Detroit, for goodness sake. But no, there's a lot going on here. Do you have any optimism on any of this moving in the next short time frame?
Well, in the question of what's moving, I find hope or optimism in the fact that there are a growing number of people who are concerned, that there are people implementing practices. I've certainly, been in audiences, even audiences with agricultural leaders, who seem to recognize that the kind of sell-by date of the voluntary-only approach may well have come, right? Because you know, the idea of establishing regulations actually provides a benefit to the people who are already doing the right thing, right? It gives you a way to, in fact, you know, support your behavior, but also identify the people that might, in fact, be causing the most problems. So, you know, there's certainly a political dimension to this no regulation argument. You know, it seems to be, you know, part of the Ten Commandments of agriculture, right, that you somehow have to say that there's no room for regulation. Ironically, of course, the whole ethanol industry is based on a regulation. If we didn't have the renewable fuel standard, there wouldn't be a market for ethanol. So apparently some regulations are good, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just the ones that you don't agree with, or that you're afraid somehow someone else is going to write. That's also one of the ironies. I mean, in most of these situations, agriculture probably write the rules themselves. Okay, well, then which part of that regulation are you afraid of? But
obviously this is sooner or later going to have a legislative approach. Do you see that beginning to happen with our current?
No, not necessarily. Yeah. Not if you're talking about at the state legislature. And unfortunately, you know, the Iowa Supreme Court in the decision on the Raccoon River case last June, in a 4-3 divided opinion, ruled against using the public trust doctrine as a basis for saying that the state had failed to meet its duty to protect the river. The argument there was that by having a voluntary-only approach, it was the same thing as essentially abdicating the responsibility. Unfortunately, the court divided in 4-3 and said, no, it's not going to allow the district court to continue with a case that would have potentially said this is something the state needs to do as relates to the raccoon. So it will continue, but you know, times can change. I think as you folks recognize, we didn't get where we are overnight. These are decisions and actions that we've taken, and so we can, in fact, make decisions and take actions that can help us undo them. Unfortunately, you know, it seems like it's maybe human nature that it sometimes takes a crisis, right? It takes a Flint, or it takes a Toledo, right? Or it takes a derecho, or it takes a Dust Bowl, right, for us to come to making a decision. And in fact, I talk about that in the book, right? And when is the right time to ask people or expect people to do more or to do the right thing for their land? Part of it's based on knowledge and what we know. And there's a great deal of effort, I think, put into trying to kind of obfuscate the numbers about water quality, or in fact, not even collect them. I mean, you look at how we managed to gut the Iowa Water Program, right? A water quality monitoring initiative. And so we're very much a don't know, don't ask, and then there's nothing you have to tell, right? And as, you know, in the book, I quote at some length from another professor named Jedediah Purdy, who writes about the land. And he says, you know, one thing about the land, it's one of those things you can always tell lies about until you can't, right, until it's too late. And then the question is, well, when do we know when it's too late, and are we smart enough to act before it gets too late?
That's true. There's a lot that we ignore to our own peril.
Willfully.
willfully. I want to take a little break here to remind you you're listening to KHOR Community Radio, and this is the Donalana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa.
Thank you.
Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking to Neil Hamilton about his new book called The Land Remains, A Midwestern Perspective on Our Past and Future. Yes, this book is about the land, but it ends up, of course, being about us and our relationship to the land. You had some things you wanted to bring up,
well,
Donna?
This chapter you've attributed to the stones we call bread, what shapes our attitudes to the land. I'm going to just read this paragraph. It says, in perhaps its most powerful metaphor, Leopold wrote, quote, when the logic of history hungers for bread and we hand out a stone, we are at pains to explain how much the stone resembles bread, unquote. He then describes some of the stones we serve up in lieu of a land ethic, an economic system valuing little other than production, an educational system teaching no ethical obligation to land, and a political system promoting conservation based primarily on economic self-interest. So then you go on in the book in a really wonderful exposition of sort of, I like to think of it as recent history. I find often we only think of history as something that happened more than 100 years ago, mainly because, you know, anything that's happened in the last 75 years probably has still, it's what we think is reality. You know, nothing happened before that, and how we arrived at the kinds of public thought processes are kind of obscured. So what you do here is you talk about, you certainly talk about Leopold's ethical questions, and then you get into Henry Wallace and the kinds of things that he did, and go through Rachel Carson and Lewis Bromfield. Now, I remember as a kid, my parents had the Lewis Bromfield books around, and we kind of don't really remember who he is anymore. You want to talk about that intellectual history, and then you end, I'm going to tell you the ending of that. I love what you've said here, Neil. You go through how, you know, especially during our childhoods, people were concerned about ethical things better than maybe we are in our national discourse. And you say, the efforts of the agricultural community in the Silent Spring era illuminated two increasing trends of large agricultural suppliers, notably the fertilizer and the chemical sector. First, their willingness to, quote, speak for farmers, and second, the willingness of farm groups, inherently conservative and free market oriented, to let them do so. So, Neil, talk about that history that brought us to through these changes in the last, say, 75 years. I think this is a wonderful illumination of current public thinking.
Well, thank you for that. And you know, that history, and let's go back, and it will maybe start at the period of the Dust Bowl, right, as we went through the 1930s.
An obvious problem, yes.
We had this combination of this economic issue in agriculture. You know, the Depression was farm-led and farm-fed. And then we had this climactic situation with the droughts in the mid-30s and the Dust Bowl and in the Eastern Plains. And then, you know, this kind of opportunity for the nation to think differently about how we dealt with agriculture and rural life and how we dealt with the land. And so you have FDR, of course, you know, this incredible heroic figure that in many ways helped to save our nation. Henry Wallace brought into that process the development of the USDA approaches. There's the famous 1937 President's Commission on Farm Security, which in fact the Iowa law that we still have today that provides advance notice to farm tenants before their tenancies can be terminated is an outgrowth of one of the recommendations of that 1937 report. This concern about the changes that were happening on the land in terms of the amount of land moving into ownership by large financial institutions, the increase in farm tenancy. And then you also had this kind of period of kind of intellectual, I think, development. And Leopold was part of that, Wallace and Bromfield. And you had this organization called the Friends of the Land, right? And you had this publication, the journal, The Land, that Russell Lord and his wife edited. And it existed for about a dozen years and was this real outlet of this thinking about our relationship to the land and agriculture is really the kind of the foundation of what today we think about as sustainable agriculture. But then as that process was going on, we were coming out of the Second War, right? Lots of technological changes in terms of mechanization, changes in crops. I mean, this is back at a period where Iowa had maybe 80,000 acres, right, of apple orchards. It was one of the largest apple producers in the nation. And within a few years after World War II, most of that had gone away. Lots of people left agriculture, right, in terms of as the technology became bigger, as we moved to tractors and hybrid corn. And so you had these kind of forces and almost in some ways crossing themselves, this kind of more ethical, some might say romanticized view of agriculture. And certainly Louis Bromfeld, he came back from, you know, Europe and bought the land in Ohio that is still there, right? It's a Ohio State Park. You can go to Malabar Farm. That Bromfeld created and wrote these books about at Malabar Farm and Pleasant Valley and Out of My Experience. And so you had that movement that in some ways was kind of the forerunner of the modern environmental movement and even the land trust movement. But portrayed against that, you had agriculture, right, becoming more what today we might look at as industrialized. Certainly many of the powerful political voices of agriculture were Southern-dominated and dominated by the American Farm Bureau Federation. I think you have to, in part, see it through the lens of the Cold War, right, that we were gearing up and fighting communism and fighting these kind of socialistic, communitarian-type values, and we were harnessing agriculture, right, to help kind of defeat communism. And then we went through this period of the 50s and 60s where a lot of those voices of conservation and land care, and of course, Leopold died in 49. The land stopped publishing in the early 50s. The Soil and Water Conservation Society and the conservation districts, and at that time, the Soil Conservation Service, SCS, they were kind of what was left. But they had also a very, you know, strong farm orientation, production orientation. We've always married conservation and production programs to our, I think, ill in the country. And so right then, you know, you didn't see a reemergence of this in many ways until you kind of came to Wendell Berry and with Rachel Carson and Silent Spring and Wendell Berry. And then,
he makes this distinction of moving from agriculture to agribusiness.
Yeah.
A change in the language.
This book, you know, The Unsettling of American Culture, Agriculture. And so then as you think about the environmental movement, as it really blossomed, right, it didn't have an agricultural basis, right? In fact, in many ways, the environmental movement saw agriculture as the unfinished business, right? The Clean Water Act exemptions, all the exemptions that agriculture had been able to carve for itself out of these statutes. And so then you created this kind of oppositional situation. And it wasn't just with the environment. It was with women's rights, consumer movements, civil rights, right? The kind of the conservative core of agricultural organizations were opposed to almost all of those major societal trends, right?
Right, and we started getting the urban, rural divide there.
Playing with your mouth full, right? And you see that, you know, still, you know, today. Anybody that's concerned about animal welfare is a radical and, you know, vegetarian who wants to end all animal agriculture, right? Anybody who raises environmental issues is a fuzzy-headed environmentalist, right, that wants to starve half the world. And so, you know, the language may have changed a little bit, but to some extent the cleavage has kind of both continued and in some ways also calcified, right, or become even harder. And so the people and organizations that try to bridge it, you know, groups like the Practical Farmers of Iowa, and in some extent the Leopold Center, right, was very much an effort to try to take the concept of sustainable agriculture which looked at both the economic necessity of agriculture, but also the environmental impacts of it, and tried to find a way to marry those two concerns to make it more sustainable. You know, they found themselves kind of in the middle, which was both an important place to be, but also a fairly fraught place to be politically. And as we see, you know, 30 years later, you know, finally the agricultural sector was finally able to basically knife and kill the Leopold Center after 30 years of wonderful progress. And I had a front row seat. I was on the Leopold Center board for 21 years from the beginning of the center and followed that. So I'm sorry, that's a long-winded answer, but I think that takes some of that history.
Well, that is important,
And part of the value of that history, I think, though, is to recognize that there were these points in time where we could have made other decisions. And whether you call them inflection points or you think about what the politics was that was involved in. So there's no reason to think that whatever trajectory we're on today was somehow predestined.
Right. It's not written in stone. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, the ethanol situation's a perfectly good example of that. I think, you know, we'll come to a better appreciation of how ethanol isn't the unalloyed answer to the future of either agriculture or energy policy that many people, you know, want to make everybody believe that it is.
It's another myth, kind of like the feeding the world myth.
Yeah, well, we used to talk about feeding the world, and it's harder to talk about now if we're taking 60% of our corn crop and grinding it up to burn. And so we've kind of, you know, we've changed the myth, and so now we say we're feeding and fueling the world.
Yeah.
Right? So you just kind of make the bumper sticker a little bigger.
It's amazing the stories we tell ourselves. Oh, my goodness.
I wanted to ask you about another thing that you have written in the book, where you talk about the European Union. We've talked about this on the radio before, and I'm watching just, you know, aghast at what's going on. But the EU, which does not allow some chemicals that we spray widely here, among other things, but they are also, they have a 2020 new farm agricultural policy, which they are calling the farm to fork idea, which to me sounds really, really, really sensible. You know, they want to convert a lot more land to organic practices. They want to do all kinds of things. And then in the book, you write about how Sonny Perdue comes along and kind of says, well, you know, basically, if you do that, everybody's going to starve. And much to my dismay, Vilsack seems to be carrying on that same attitude. Do you want to talk a little bit about the European direction versus what we're doing here?
Sure. This is a subject I know a little bit about. I mean, for about 20 years, I taught a class in France every year to a group of French agriculture and food students, and have a lot of friends that worked in the European Union. And I think it's important to recognize that the European agricultural policy has always been different in the United States, right? The CAP, or the Common Agricultural Policy, had a dimension to it that we never did, never had, and that was the social dimension, right?
Yes.
And the recognition that it takes people on the land to actually have the landscape and the type of land that you think of. And so European agriculture had a much more direct concern about rural communities and new farmers and supporting the farmers who were there. Our policy was, while we paid a fair amount of lip service to the people in agriculture, we certainly never had a policy of trying to maintain the same size of a farm sector, right? Instead, in fact, our policy in many ways was a get bigger, get out. We encouraged a lot of consolidation. And in fact, government programs oftentimes helped support that. And so the EU and the U.S. have always had this different approach when it came to agriculture. And then when you add in other things like the precautionary principle and what type of technologies would be allowed, right? And I mean, the U.S. has been sucking a sore lip about Europe for a long time, right? They won't accept beef with hormones, right? They don't want to approve the type of biotechnology traits, right? And we, you know, we've never met a technology that we wouldn't adopt, right? And we'll keep doing it until we've figure out that maybe it's killing us. And so when you flash forward to where we are today, right, and Europe, understandably, moving forward with a much more socially, environmentally structured agricultural system, the farm-to-fork policy, and, you know, very much different than what we would do. But we have components of it. We certainly have organic agriculture. In fact, the USDA, at least on paper, responsible for administering, you know, that system. But then at an international stage, right, the United States doesn't have any qualms about criticizing the Europeans or, oh, my gosh, this is terrible what you're doing. You're assigning, you know, part of the world to starvation. And you know, it's you know, the U.S. is very committed to this idea that it's got to be technologically oriented, that, you know, it's a production-oriented system, right? I mean, you take organic agriculture, for example. You know, the USDA is never going to be able to say organic food is somehow safer for you or better for you, because implicitly that means that it's somehow safer than the rest of the food system. So instead, all they can say is, well, it's a different marketing approach, right? Whereas Europeans would probably admit, no, it's probably better for you from a health standpoint, better for the land, and you know, that's why we would support it. And so not surprising, though perhaps to put words in your mouth, disappointing, that American agricultural leaders of both the past and of the present would somehow try to denigrate what the Europeans are doing and saying that this is a wrong approach. To me, it seems a little ironic or foolish, because if the subtext of that is that the Europeans are somehow going to make themselves less competitive because they won't be as productive or their food will cost more, well, more the merrier, right? All the benefit to us, right? In that it makes our products more competitive, and if they're willing to forego part of the world market for U.S. grains, then why wouldn't we encourage them to do more of this, right? I mean, even from a political or economic standpoint, our attacks on the Europeans don't hold water unless, at the end of the day, we're afraid that maybe they're right and that we may catch this illness of the reasonableness, right, or recognizing that you don't need to do certain things. You know, certainly
you don't need that much fertilizer.
That you can, yeah, that you can raise livestock in ways that are different than ours, right? That you don't need to feed growth. You don't need to feed antibiotics as a growth promoter, right? They've been able to get along without, you know, the Brits and Europe have been able to get along without chicken drugged through a chlorine bath, right? in differences in their attitudes towards food safety. So, right, it's understandable that we believe what we're doing is right. Right, we wouldn't be doing it otherwise, right? And so
I don't know if belief is a strong word there, Neil.
Belief.
Right? I'm not sure it's that we believe it. I think there's an economic impetus to that that's beyond belief.
But we believe in money too. So believe is
all right,
part of
we
that
believe
too,
in the money. So, okay.
There you go.
And we believe that it's all about cheap food. And
well,
unfortunately, it's cheap perhaps in quality as opposed to in value.
Well, but the funny thing is, and you'll know this from being in France regularly, the price of vegetables there, of good quality vegetables, of course, since you grow your own, you may not have noticed the market prices, but the food is much more expensive here, actually.
Well, that's certainly one of the unfortunate ironies of our situation, right? If you encourage people to eat better, eat healthier, eat fresh, and then they find that that's even that much more expensive than the processed food and the canned food,
right,
and other things. And so it creates a real kind of a social justice dimension, unfortunately, to food and nutrition that makes the situation even that much more troubling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's take a little break just to remind you that this is KHOI Community Radio, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Uh, Donna had a question.
I do, Neil. This is not in the book because it's very recent news is, of course, what do you think that, you know, the disruption of the grain supplies from this Ukrainian unfortunate situation is going to do to some of these issues, like we were talking about food in Europe, and, you know, the pronouncements have been rather dire.
Well, it has certainly helped us remind us how interconnected we are. And while only a relatively small percent of the food consumed in the world moves in international trade, there are some commodities and some countries that can play an outsized role. And I think that many people have been surprised to know how much of the wheat trade, particularly in Africa and other parts of the world, come from the Ukraine and come from Russia. And so you've had, right, this incredible disruption and increases in prices and now dislocation. And, of course, as food gets more expensive and people who are at the lower end of the economic spectrum may slide more into poverty or have difficulty acquiring it. And so it's brought front and center a lot of those kind of food insecurity issues and the fact that we can't be complacent about it. I think there's a dimension to it that we maybe haven't thought as much about, or maybe we haven't necessarily seen how the other shoe might drop, and that is the kind of food and fuel debate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as we continue to try to stress the idea of biofuels and renewable fuels and ethanol, and, you know, we're going to turn more corn into fuel, and we're going to go for E15, or now we're going to put more soybeans into biodiesel, it has an impact on food prices. There isn't any two ways around it, and any economist would tell you that, right? And you can't have both worlds, right? I mean, you can't use all your corn crop to burn for ethanol and not have it have some impact on the price of corn as a feedstock. And, you know, I mean, corn's trading at almost record prices now for corn. And now I'm sure, you know, the ethanol folks, if they're listening, you know, they would tell you all the reasons that that's a false choice between, you know, food or fuel. But, you know, the only reason we developed the ethanol market in the first place is because we had more damn corn we knew what to do with.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, we have developed technologies. High fructose corn syrup was a perfect example. I mean, the PL480, the Food for Peace program in the 1950s was developed largely as a surplus food disposal system from the United States, right? And we could wrap it in humanitarian trappings, even though it oftentimes then was dislocating the agriculture of the countries that were the recipients of our, quote, food aid. And we've kind of learned some of those, you know, lessons. And food aid
kind
will be most effective when it's produced closest to wherever it's being provided, right, as opposed to being a surplus that we happen to have. And so we've identified other ways to use our surplus. And I can remember, you know, 30 years ago or so, as we were putting the first kind of corn cob-shaped decals on gas pumps, saying, you know, that this gasoline has 10% gasohol in it, right? And it was a big deal. I mean, oh, my gosh. You know, and this is back during, in some ways, in the farm crisis. I don't think anybody at that time assumed that, flash forward a generation, we were going to be grinding 60% of Iowa's corn crop and burning it for fuel and then rationalizing why we're doing it. You know, and there isn't anything, well, let's say for the sake of argument, there isn't anything inherently wrong with ethanol. But there are some problems with how we raise corn, right? We still haven't dealt with soil conservation, and I talk about that at a fair length in the book in a chapter about the myths we tell ourselves about soil conservation. We certainly have water quality issues. And the underlying, I think, reality is we do about everything we can to keep our foot on the accelerator of all-out production, right? And we farm the land harder. We expect more from it, right? And all of these different events, whether it's a war or using it for fuel, kind of help us do that. And we ask an awful lot of the land, and we oftentimes don't necessarily ask much about what the land may need back from us, right? As Leopold said, we know what the land's for. It's to drip honey into Abraham's mouth, right? And our land's purpose is to drip honey into our mouths. And we should be very grateful and thankful that we have pretty productive land that's done that. It's not as productive as it used to be. We certainly are losing lots of topsoil, lots of carbon content, lots of water holding capacity. That's part of what's making our flooding problems worse is land with less carbon, more compact, more water sheeting off of it in relatively small rains. And so, you know, if we cared about this land this much and it was worth this much to us, I would think we'd do a little bit more taking care of it. So issues like soil health and conservation. But, you know, we're pretty much tied onto the economic train, and my gosh, I've got to push that land and make it jump.
These are really important things. I'm glad you wrapped that up with our concern, where our concern really is. And I think we'll be waking up to these issues.
Hopefully.
Hopefully, yes. We've been talking to Neil Hamilton. He has written a great book that opens up a lot of possibilities for discussion. It's called The Land Remains, A Midwestern Perspective on Our Past and Future. And you live on a farm now. It's spring. In just a few minutes we have left. What's happening on your farm in the spring?
Well, we're waiting for this cold weather and this wind to stop, right? I mean, I've tilled up a number of the beds and planted about 1,600 leeks the other day in one of the beds. And so some of the leeks are in. And the garlic's up, and, you know, lots of plants are started in the greenhouse and waiting to be transplanted. And so there's that promise of spring, but, I mean, I'm sure if you look at your calendars, you may have been out picking morels by this time a year ago, right? It's cold out there. The ground's still cold. And so it's going to be a late spring, I think, which is, you know, hopefully... You know, if you had an apple orchard, you haven't been faced with early bud break, right? Because there was never any warm weather to bring out the buds. And so hopefully we'll now move into a stretch of weather and actually have spring.
Good. Well, thank you for being with us. This is good.
You put your hands in the soil, you believe in the future, right? And that's the whole the whole issue of gardening. And I really appreciate the opportunity to be with you. People can buy the book from Ice Cube Press or at their local bookstores, and if people are interested in me coming and talking to their group or visiting with them about the book, I'd certainly be interested in that as well.
Good.
Well, thank you, Neil, for being such a good Midwestern voice. We really appreciate it.
Yes, we do. Thank you. Good.
Thank you, ladies.
Good. Well, Earth Day is coming up, and there's some events coming up, especially right here on KHOI on Saturday the 23rd, Saturday the 23rd is going to have an Earth Day on the air starting early in the morning, and it's in cooperation with the City of Ames. So thinking about the whole Earth, but also thinking about how our local community can address some of these issues. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We come to you live every Tuesday at noon. We're repeated at 7 p.m. Tuesday evening. For more information, go to khoifm.org. Find out more about this fine radio station.
Or you can listen to us on podcast. This podcast will be released on Thursday. Just go to wherever you listen to podcasts and type in Donna Lana. That's one word, Donna Lana Kitchen. And up will come the podcast.
We will be there. My name is Lana Noctica.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.